Hello, this is The Link Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com in channel Pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
And we're back.
It's The Linux Show for November 11th, 2003. We are back for another episode of the latest and greatest of the Linux community. And bringing you our weekly, hopefully not train wreck, of the news and views of what's going on with Linux and open source. We're going to have a scaled down panel this week. Doc got stuck in the air during showtime, so he will not be joining us tonight. But that's okay. With a little bit of luck, who knows, maybe his plane will land and he'll get to hook up with us on the cell phone while he's taxiing down the runway. So we'll see what happens as it happens. But it is another Tuesday night, and we're going to just continue on with what we do here every week. A couple of notices that I should bring to everybody's attention. First of all, we are being sponsored tonight by the good whims of the brought to us by the generosity, I should say, of a number of different independent listeners out there this week. None of them have saw fit to actually take advantage of the sponsorships to plug the companies or the Linux user groups that they are members of. So I emailed them and just said, what if I just went ahead and used the opportunity to plug somebody else in the Linux community who might need a little bit of support? And they said, sure, fine. So I wanted to just take the opportunity on behalf of the people who contributed during the course of last week, and there was quite a list of them, surprisingly enough. They collectively chose between them LPI, Linux Professional Institute, for everybody to go visit www.lpi.org. LPI is not soliciting for funds at this time, but they are soliciting for help. So if you are a member of a Linux user group, the LPI could use your help right now. What the LPI is doing right now is putting on a series of events across the nation that they're co-sponsoring with Linux user groups and in some cases with a couple of small colleges. And they are going to go around the nation getting people passed in terms of their LPI certification tests. So if you got the opportunity, please check out lpi.org and send them an email. Drop an email and tell them that you or your LUG would love to get involved in LPI and help them out for their efforts. They're one of the few organizations within the Linux community that right now is totally funded but really needs volunteer staff to take advantage of that total funding. So, again, www.lpi.org, and when you email them, make sure that you let them know that you are motivated by the listeners of the Linux Show. So make sure you go check them out as soon as you have an opportunity. But thanks again to all those people who did step forward and sponsor. They sponsored between the group of people who sponsored, we're pretty well covered for the month, which is an unusual thing for us to be covered ahead of time. We're not working from behind, so that's a nice sailing. But I'm going to go ahead and bring in those members of the panel that are here tonight. Arnie, you are our sole California contingent tonight, so how you doing?
Oh, it's pretty nice today. I had a day off and got some things accomplished around the house and got to kick back a little bit and back to school tomorrow. So it's pretty nice here. It's perfect earthquake weather.
Perfect earthquake weather, but at least the fires have stopped, huh?
Yeah, well, they got those out.
Yep. Oh, that's good. Little rain helps. 24 hours of rain will change anybody's outlook on life, huh?
Yeah, well, it's the first rain I've seen in the years in this infernal state. It's kind of cloudy tonight. It might rain again, which is more rain the better.
Yeah, well, at least for a while until the reservoirs and aqueducts are all filled up. So,
yeah.
Then. Out of the other end of the country, Russ Pavlicek, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, hanging in. It's definitely cold out this way, as I'm sure it is in Chicago at this point. Things have brisked up, and looks like the fall has finally fallen.
Yeah. Russ, are you heading out to Comdex next week?
No, I'm not.
I sort of expected you to. You've been traveling so much lately. I am unexpectedly going to be going to Vegas next week, but more on that later in the show. But how are you doing tonight, Kevin?
Oh, pretty good.
How's Mary? Yes? Hello?
Hello.
You there?
Yep.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. All of a sudden you went dead quiet. How is married life treating you?
Oh, not too bad. Although I think my headset is dying. I'm not sure how that has to do with marriage, but...
I think it must be, because you're going in and out, at least from my end. You may want to play around with your connection there.
Oh.
And just as a surprise, since we're introducing everybody, I didn't know this was going to happen, but it's always okay with me when this does happen. I see Eric Raymond's on the phone. Eric, how are
you? Yes, I am.
How are you doing tonight, Eric?
Good. I'm about to issue a rant about clueless CSS designers. We can talk about that later.
Okay. That's you're welcome, too. Okay. But let's go ahead and jump in with the first segment, everybody, because we do have a guest joining us in, about 20-25 minutes. And so segment number two is filled up with Marcel, our buddy Marcel, and we're going to be talking about his new book. And but before we do, hey, Eric, how's your new book going?
Oh, it's doing pretty well. My editor tells me it's selling very briskly.
Well, that's good.
And it's getting good reviews all over Amazon. Lots of people like it. Everybody's pleased.
Yeah. Well, they should be. It's a great book. I spewed enough on it a couple weeks ago, but it is really a great book. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at Marcel's new book, but it's also quite remarkable. There's been so many great...
Title?
The title of Marcel's new book is Moving to Linux.
Kiss the Blue Screen of Death Goodbye.
This book is specifically tailor-made to newbies.
Ah.
It's really good.
I may be incompetent to evaluate it then.
Oh, no, you'll like it, Eric. It's one of those that kind of just grabs you. It's done with a suitable amount of light.
Gallic flair, eh?
Yeah, well, you know, north of the border type Gallic flair. It's very, very, it's very well done, you would like it.
Yeah, the humor is Canadian; it's not French.
Yeah,
that's for damn sure. That's no doubt about that. But let's go ahead and jump into the first segment. We'll talk about Marcel's book in segment number two, but that's definitely something to look forward to. All right, Russ, why don't you kick us off tonight? What's your first couple stories of the night?
Okay, a real quickie one that I didn't get a chance to get on the webpage, so there's no link out there. But if you go to brunswickwdi.com, and people may recognize the name. I think I mentioned it, or some of us mentioned it in one of the earlier programs, how Brunswick actually built their business integration engine and then decided to open source it because it made sense from their vantage point to try to build a community around it for further development, et cetera. And they have announced a programming contest. And prizes, from what I see, can go up as high as $1,500 if you can contribute something of a particular merit to this effort. So, so if you're in that mindset and you want to try to add something to an enterprise level piece of open source software, check them out. That's at brunswickwdi.com/user_contributions.
Let's have that one more time.
brunswickwdi.com/user_contributions. So
I hate to do this to you, Russ, but you need to spell Brunswick. I mean, not everybody knows how to spell it.
Okay, let's go there. You see, I unfortunately know it all too well because I grew up bowling at a Brunswick lane, so I used to see that thing ad nauseum. But Brunswick is B as in boy, R as in Robert, U, N as in Nancy, S as in Sam, W, I, C as in Charles, K, WDI.com.
Brunswick is one of those companies that has gone through just enormous amounts of changes over the years.
Yeah, they do a lot of things, and one of the more interesting things that they've done was realizing that it wasn't in their core business plan to be software developers. So, despite the fact that they built this this framework for them for their own purposes, it didn't make sense for them to just keep it locked up and have to deal with maintenance and expansion for it forever. So they saw the wisdom of open sourcing it, because from their vantage point it reduces their cost to maintain, but of course from everyone else's vantage point that gives everyone else an enterprise level tool that can be used in other businesses as well. So that's really neat.
We can see a lot of this in the vertical markets that have opened up their software, and the idea here is to leverage the community of users, and of course there's all sorts of other benefits as well.
Yeah, they really don't give any limit. So what I found interesting, just take a quick look at the website, they don't show any limits to the cash prizes, because so I think this is probably an ongoing thing for them. They're using it as a marketing means to acquire talent. So,
from the release that they sent me, which I just opened up here a few minutes ago, unfortunately, it says the challenge runs from November 10th to midnight, February 9th, 2004, and that. In the actions and message formatter categories, first prizes will be $1,000, and the first prize for software-specific connectors is $1,500, and in addition, there will be up to 10 honorable mention prizes, which can be awarded across all three categories for significant contributions that do not win any of the first prizes. So, if you like coding, if you like dealing with stuff in the enterprise, and you like maybe the idea of getting a prize check when you're all done, check it out.
Yep.
Now back on to the normal links out on the Linux Show webpage. Here's one that will confound people. It's about Internet Explorer to finally stop pop-ups. And what the hell does this have to do with Linux? Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, here we have Microsoft Innovation coming in and doing something that Mozilla and Opera have done for so long that I can't remember when the features were ever added. I mean, I've been running with suppressed pop-ups for months and months and months and months. And this is just one of those things to note when you start hearing the drivel about how only corporations can innovate and break new ground. Here we see a very long overdue imitation of innovation that is happening inside open source circles.
Yeah, how about those Internet Explorer tabs? I mean, you know, something else that came out of Opera and Mozilla.
Does Internet Explorer have tabs?
I don't know. Anybody use Internet Explorer around there? Can answer the question.
I don't know.
Sorry, can't help you.
That's why I asked, because I wasn't aware that it had tabs. I do see it from time to time at school, just walking by computers, but I don't recall ever seeing tabs on the screen, but could be wrong.
At school, I use Firebird.
Okay. Well, next story up is from Forbes.com, and it's a little piece called Holding Up Hollywood, about our best buddies from Utah there, SCO. Apparently, since they're not getting the payday they expected out of IBM quite yet, if ever, they are now deciding that they're going to rant and rave towards Hollywood, which of course is using large Linux-based rendering farms, expecting to be able to threaten them into buying licenses and making...
Ponying up for the $699 CPU tariff. this great article by Daniel Lyons. Heck of a nice guy. I've had a number of conversations with him over this past week, starting middle of last week, actually, because of a whole series of articles that he has been writing over the last, month or two, and his fascination with the way that the Linux community behaves. Just, it never seems, no matter what he says, he always gets flamed by somebody, and I told him, it's just something you have to get used to, and eventually you get thick-skinned, and it doesn't bother you anymore. But he's really just fairly recently, last couple months, started writing articles about Unix and Linux and open source for Forbes, and he really is, not only an outsider of software development in general. He's, a financial guy. He's really not in the computer business, so this is a very foreign subject for him. But it's surprising how savvy he has gotten very quickly, and that he can completely see through this sham instantly. The people are getting clued in. It's amazing what a great favor SCO has really been doing for us over the last, month and a half or so, ranting on things like this article. They're becoming our greatest ally, trying to hold up Hollywood. What a stupid thing to do.
Yes, well, Linux is upholding Hollywood. SCO is sticking up Hollywood.
Yeah,
well, there's an interesting thing here. One of the more frightening points of this article had nothing to do with the actual theme of the article, but it talks about how SCO stock used to be less than a dollar and has gone to over $17, and then throws in, even at that price, Deutsche Bank analyst Brian Skiba rated SCO a buy, saying that it could hit $45 in the short term.
Oh, God, that's disgusting.
it amazes me that anyone in their right mind would tell people to buy SCO stock when, if you look at the case at all, eventually this thing's going to crash down to the ground and flame out. And it's like, who thinks this is a sound investment? That's what I want to know. It stuns me. It stupefies me. It's just amazing. But that's what's happening, believe it or not, some circles in the financial community.
You see, the financial community does operate on a completely different level than we do. The financial markets are in large measure driven by emotion. There's this old saying about stockbrokers, and that their buy recommendations are you buy on rumor and you sell on fact. And so right now we're still in the pre-court phase of IBM versus SCO. So we're still in the rumor phase. So we're still on the buy cycle.
Right.
It won't hit a sell cycle until they walk into court with IBM. And then they will change the recommendation. to a cell, or a hole, maybe, but there, because of the fact it's still rumors, and the, you know, the there are enough people out there that are, you know, buying the bullshit and believing, well, you know, well, what if? What if these guys win? What if they win their $3 billion payday? If they win that $3 billion payday, that stock's going to be worth, you know, $500 a share. You know, and so it's that what if that's fueling it. And it's all BS, but it's still, that's the way things on Wall Street work, is you buy on rumors, sell on facts. And
on suppositions.
Well, whatever you want to call them. It's just, you always buy on a news story, but you sell once facts are actually released about the company. Like, companies will all, their stock prices will run up just prior to an SEC filing, and as soon as the SEC filing comes out, boom, they drop.
Yep.
Because of speculating. So that's just the way it is.
Dave Mooring just sent a link to the IRC that, with the title from Forbes magazine, IBM subpoenas SCO investors and analysts.
Ooh.
Thank you, David.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, that it was an inevitability. Everything you've seen come out of IBM today that was not a press release about product was a press release about subpoenas. For the first time since the beginning of this case, you're actually seeing serious press releases coming out of IBM about their efforts to have discovery. They put a full court press on a week ago to get discovery. And so that's interesting.
I can tell you why.
Well, sure, they know why. There's no facts to the case.
But this may not be obvious to all of our listeners. IBM is now in a situation where, just going by the documents that have been published on Grok Law, there is a substantial likelihood that they can get the judge to actually quash this case if SCO doesn't come forward with some actual responses to discoveries. And that's why they're beginning to crank up the public pressure.
Well, I can completely corroborate that, Eric, because that is exactly what a representative of IBM told me yesterday. Exactly. That they are going to go for either one of those two actions. There's plenty of evidence out there. They said, in the opinion of IBM, the case is a done deal. They're going to win. And so it's getting it over with, you know, starting the discovery phase, or have a summary decision, one of the two. And SCO doesn't want to, SCO doesn't really want to go to court, I don't think.
No, I wouldn't either in their shoes.
not with what the evidence is. Their only chance right now, really long term, is, you know, hoping and praying that somebody buys them out before this thing actually gets to court.
You know what a Section 11 motion is?
I'm not sure. No.
Yeah. I don't have any special ability to read the minds of IBM's lawyers, but if I were in their shoes, I would be looking at filing a Section 11 motion, which is what you say to the court when you think the other side's lawyers have basically knowingly alleged falsehoods to mislead the court.
Ooh.
Well,
if I were in their shoes, I'd have to be thinking about that.
Well, if I was in Daryl McBride's shoes, I would be thinking that right now of, what have I been doing listening to these people?
Well, you know, there's a certain sense in which he didn't have anything to lose.
Yeah, well, I suppose. And, well...
they sure didn't have a business.
Yeah, very clearly. When it all boils down to this, what I've been calling the last several days, the suckiness factor. When your company is just totally sucky, when there's nothing good about your management, nothing good about your business plan, you might as well sue somebody. So you've got nothing else left.
Welcome to our litigious society.
That's for sure. Russ, got any more stories?
Yeah, one last quickie. From Grok Law, The Grinch Who Stole Linux.
That's a good one, yes.
Yes, the parody of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas, talking, of course, about our best buddies at SCO.
Yeah, every GNU down in GNUville.
Yeah, actually, this is like the third, maybe even fourth version of The Grinch Who Stole Linux that I've seen.
Hmm.
But this one by Scott Lazar is really well developed. I mean, he really spent some time last week, obviously, getting all the rhymes right. It's not easy doing Dr. Seuss. It's, it takes a lot of work. So, no, it was very funny. Good read. If you haven't read it, everybody go check out Grokla and then read the real stuff there while you're there. There's some great things at Grokla this week. That's for sure. Well, why don't Eric? Why don't you? You said you wanted to rant a little bit.
Yeah, I moved my blog space this week. I used to be hosted on Blogspot. I have a blog called Armed and Dangerous, as some of you probably know. I write about lots of different things, mostly not software. And I moved my blog this week to a blog engine called B2. And one of the things that comes with B2 is this default CSS style sheet to make your blog presentation all pretty. And it triggered a pet peeve of mine, which is people who put absolute pixel sizes in CSS descriptions. Does everybody here understand why this is brain dead?
It's brain dead. Let the rendering engine take care of it.
Well, there's something specific going on here. When you do what a lot of stupid graphics designers do and say, oh, I want an 11-pixel font because it makes the spacing look really good on my 1024 by 768 display, guess what happens to people like me who have 1492 by 2048 displays with 100 DPI rather than 72 DPI? Got it first time. The font looks tiny. It turns into FlySpec 3. You get eye strain. Dumb. The fundamental problem here is that these so-called web designers don't understand that there are different sizes and shapes of displays out there. And beyond that, they don't understand that the user is supposed to pick the font. You aren't supposed to pick the font. The user is supposed to pick the font. So I had to spend a couple of hours going through their bloody broken CSS, ripping out all the absolute pixel sizes, and doing what the bloody web designer should have done in the first place, which is scale all the box sizes and things in terms of EM and EX units, which say this is relative to the current font size. So this is a shout out to any listeners who are doing web design. Don't be a moron. Let the user pick the font size. Don't ever use an absolute pixel size in that situation.
And don't presume a screen size either. Just
yeah.
let the render engine scale things normally.
Yeah. It's disappointing.
No, I think you do have to presume something about monitors. I'll disagree with you there. I think.
Well, I mean, you know,
you got to presume that most people are really stupid, and so you're dealing with a worst case scenario in most monitors. And
but I've got a 1600 by 1200 screen. I mean, I don't want things rendered for 768 by, you know.
Yeah, that makes it more important to avoid pixel sizes and screen size assumptions, not less, Jeff.
Oh no, I don't disagree with that. No,
yeah.
Not at all. So, okay. Well, Arnie, now that Eric's done with his rant, you have a bunch of stories you got to get to.
Well, I got three ones, and I'll make it brief because we want to get Marcel in here. There's an article from Peter Williams, who's been doing some fairly good stuff on VNUNet. Novell deal, good for Linux, bad for SCO, and he talks about Gartner. And this goes back to what I was saying last week about the Novell buyout of SUSE, and that is they're trying to fatten their product line and make NetWare scale better to different technologies and stuff. And it's a good little article, and it sounds like the press in general is coming out fairly favorably on the buyout, and I would have to concur with that.
Well, I think it's probably split 60-40?
I can do it.
60% positively, 40% negatively?
Yeah, but the objections I've heard aren't anything that would you know, hit my radar screen.
Well, I think the major you know, fundamental perspective that people have a negative feeling about is that, okay, if you're a duck, you've got duck DNA, right? And it's hard for you to, just because you ate a worm, to change your DNA and be half duck and half worm, right? It's not something that you can do for sure overnight, is to change your DNA. And just like an animal has DNA, a corporation has a distinct corporate culture. And there's no question that Novell has a distinct corporate culture. And that corporate DNA, whatever you want to call it, has not historically been very successful at absorbing other companies. Now, there's no question that the management team at Novell is not the management team it was a few years ago. Hell, that management team's in Skull right now.
Well, I mean, that's what everybody's saying, and the fact is that the corporate DNA at Novell is basically an unknown thing. One thing we do know is that the technical people at Novell have been into Unix for some number of years. And they've been toying with it for some time. And this could be another, and this was what another pundit was saying, this could be a situation where, like IBM, where the people in Novell were using Linux in-house for some time. And I don't know that this is true, but IBM came to Linux through that very, very path. And I think that we'll find out that Novell also has decided to turn the corner as well, and I just don't buy your argument.
Well, first of all, it's not my argument. I can see the validity in the argument, but I think Arnie, I think that the quarter's out. I think it's going to take some time before.
That's right.
I think before we can make any kind of.
I think in the short run, I think it's a good move, and what will happen? I think what's going to happen through it. Is that Novell is going to come out with NetWare for a variety of platforms, which they couldn't do before scaling coming to Linux,
yep.
And that's a very important thing for Linux too.
Yeah, if you go look on the list of things we got up on the site tonight is a Novell analysis by Doc, and what Doc did is interviewed a whole bunch of his old fart friends.
I read it.
And one of the things that's out on I found relatively interesting about the process that Novell is going to have to go through is that we really are going to have to take a complete wait and see on this because there are so many shifts and so many changes that Novell has gone through as a company in the last 2 years, and that SUSE has gone through as a company in the last 2 years. I mean, come on, look what SUSE went through with that United Linux reshuffling. And
oh yeah,
all that stuff. So both companies are really in a fairly serious state of flux right now, and is it a probable, logical, good move for both companies? Yeah, it may be the only thing they could do.
Well, I always liked SUSE too. I used SUSE for some number of years, and it was always it's always been a very good distribution. And in Europe, it's one of the biggies, and with good reason. It's quite stable and it runs very well.
So, what do you guys all think about Ransom Love?
That's my next story.
Yes. I want to point out that we're seeing a pretty classic industry consolidation thing going on here.
Yep.
Can everybody remember when there were a dozen distributions that you could claim were important?
Yeah.
Now there are exactly three.
Well, and a couple others on the sideline that are pretty important too. I mean, you're talking about Sousa, Red Hat, and Debian, right?
Yeah.
Okay, how about Mandrake and a couple others too?
Well, last I heard, Mandrake was in pretty deep trouble and going Chapter 9 or Chapter 11 or something like that.
Well, also, they just announced something either today or yesterday, another alliance with Mandrake.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have it in front of me, so they're not falling into the hole totally yet.
Yeah.
Yep. Well,
my next story is Caldera founder joins board of Progeny Linux, which is... interestingly enough, it comes out of the Debian people,
the founder of Debian.
Yeah, Ian Murdoch, and this is interesting. I just quite don't know what to think about it. Welcome back, Ransom. But I hope you get some clue this time. Maybe some association with Ian will help.
Well, I don't think that's anything but inevitable. The whole Progeny thing, though, is real interesting. The timing, the fact that, well, at least the rumor that I'm hearing about very large financial backing, and yet it's only a 25-man company. Obviously, there's people out there who knew about the handwriting on the wall with Fedora coming, you know? And Ian putting together a group like Progeny, that it really looks like they're going to step into that niche that Red Hat just walked away from. And that's a very, very gutsy and ambitious move. And I think it's going to be really interesting. I think it also possibly might... Kevin, you and I were talking about this last week, about, you know, with Fedora coming along, should we convert over to Debian? And you were saying that would be really cool, except for it takes Debian forever to come out with a new distro. And, with the Progeny out there, and now with Fedora in place, that we may see some cross-pollination very shortly between Fedora and Debian with Progeny in place. And who knows what's going to happen to Debian? It may fall into the niche that Red Hat just took a pass on. So. I think it's an interesting story, because obviously, if Ian's pulling together people like Ransom Love, he's looking for corporate image. Is that the right word, Eric?
Yeah.
I don't know. He's looking for people that look like a respectable board of directors to get, you know, $100 million worth of backing. Yeah. So, I don't know. But I think it's a real cool story. So, anything else, sir?
No, that's about it. I had one other, but that's it's the link is on the page, and that's the virtual handler in Windows is going to support Windows, not support Linux, but you can run Linux
run
on
Linux.
It.
Yeah, run Linux on Microsoft.
Of course, as soon as they collaborate, so it doesn't do that. VMware stock will go up.
Yeah, well, we'll see, won't we? We've also got a couple of other links up on the site, a couple of stories that people want to take interest at. One of them is the Penguins for President, a really interesting article. It's sort of like one of those clue train type observations in terms of what campaigns are running what as far as their serverware, and then go to their websites and look what they're using their websites for. It really does give you a really interesting hint as to the level of sophistication, the level at which a particular campaign has embraced technology. Virtually every one of the websites you go to where it's got a really bad website, it's running Microsoft IIS.
One of the things that I found interesting about that, regardless of any politics,
yeah,
was that the two big parties, one of them is running Microsoft IIS and Windows, and the other one is running Apache, and Doc cites their uptime. Microsoft IIS had an uptime of 4.26 days with a maximum of 39 days and a 90-day moving average of 17 days. And the other party had, which was running Apache on Linux, had an uptime of 445 days, also the maximum, and a 90-day moving average of almost 400 days. And basically, the thing hadn't been rebooted in over a year.
That's two orders of magnitude. Huge.
It's astounding. It's astounding when you look at the uptime graphs of the two parties and realize, you know, how much more stable the Linux server has been. And, you know, it's just interesting.
And my favorite third party is running Linux. I happen to know that.
Oh, yeah. And then there's another third party that's probably running Linux.
Okay. The Daily Libertarian Party can't find enough Linux geeks to run its website.
And I think the Green Party runs Linux, too.
What?
I think the Green Party runs Linux, too.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, of course they do. That's because they're all a bunch of commie libs, right?
Yeah,
stop that.
Okay, well, I tell you what, everybody, we're going to kick back and take a break. It is 42 after the hour. We do want to come back on the other side of the break with Marcel, talk about his book. So everybody, go replenish your beverage, come back in a few minutes, and we're going to come back and talk about the book, Moving to Linux, in just a few minutes. So hang in there, everybody. Sit back.
Nobody's problem.
And we're back.
And we're back. It's the Linux Show, segment number two. Boy, we were just chatting away like crazy. We almost missed the cue to come back into the show. Things will happen. But we're going to just jump right in here. Segment number two. Marcel is on the line now. Eric's still here. We're talking about Marcel's book. First of all, for those of you who have been living under a rock for the last several years, Marcel does have one of the most well-received regular columns at the Linux Journal. And first of all, boy, I've got to respect you, period, when you've got the patience to write a regular series of articles for the Linux Journal. That in itself can be an enormous frustration.
Now, those people have been great to me over the years.
Oh, they're great people. I love them to death. But
yes, so do I.
Getting something posted on their website can take an eternity.
Welcome, Marcel Gagne, to the Linux Show.
Well, thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, that's cool.
I've been a big fan of your monthly articles for some time on the Linux Journal. They are just, they taste great.
I detect cooking, an ongoing
cooking
gastronomy
with,
metaphor here.
Yes, cooking with Linux, the single most controversial piece of, the most controversial technical column Linux Journal has ever published, and apparently very popular.
It's a user column. It's a column for users of Linux. It's not a column for the dyed-in-the-heart kernel hacker. It's for the people who just for use it.
Well, every once in a while, I try to get a little meaty.
Oh yeah, you do. Yeah, with lots of spice on it. It's very good.
Yeah.
Thank you. And of course, every wine I every month I choose a wine. You know, so
yeah. And you have to have that. I mean, you know, I've got my glass right here. You know, however, tonight I'm drinking Two Buck Chuck, which is famous at Trader Joe's here in California.
Okay.
Two Buck Chuck?
Charles Adams Winery.
You know, I don't think I want to know.
It's wonderful. For $2 a bottle, you can't beat it.
Well, I'll tell you what, next time I'm in the neighborhood, you'll have to introduce me.
I will gladly do that.
Well, what's the amazing thing about Two Buck Chuck is it's a Napa wine. It's amazing anybody can pay the taxes on a Napa Valley property by only charging $2 a bottle for that wine.
The winery has gone out of business, I understand. It's just that Trader Joe's bought out their entire stock of wine.
Oh, is that why they could do it? Well, like I said, you couldn't pay the taxes.
I could be wrong, but I think that's what's happened, and it's delightful for $2.
Well, so if it's out of business, it's now a collector's item. Got to stock away a case.
Well, okay, now we're pushing wine on the show.
Now we got to push wine. Marcel.
Yes.
Your book is called Moving to Linux, Kiss the Blue Screen of Death Goodbye.
Yes.
And it certainly fits the recipe. There we go again.
Okay.
This book is very readable. I read it basically within a day from cover to cover. And I've reread many parts of it again. And what you're trying to do? What are you trying to accomplish with this book? Now, obviously, this is targeted at the non-Linux user. But what are you trying to accomplish with this book? And what are you, you know, what's next then? I mean, you've got to have some ideas for something to go around this thing, because this is really a good start.
Oh yeah, I mean, obviously, I have some ideas. In fact, I'm working on my third book, which actually just contracted to do just recently, and I'm at work on the third book, but I won't get into that right now. What I was trying to do with this book, actually, was, for years, of course, I've been hearing that, you know, Linux is just too hard, you know, it's too complicated, and the average person just couldn't possibly ever work with it. And, of course, the phrase that just, you know, always drove me nuts was the ones, you know, it's too complicated for the secretary in the office. And, of course, that used to really drive me nuts, because the secretary often runs the office, right? So we certainly weren't, you know, I didn't think that people were being given enough credit for what they could do. And of course, I have to give you a little backstory here. You know, it's a story I've told a million times, but I'll tell it again because this is my first time telling it on the Linux Show. But back in 2000, when I was already starting to tell people, hey, you know, I think the Linux desktop is ready for regular use, and people were telling me I was insane,
my parents were going to get their first computer. Their first computer, as in they've never had one before, okay? My parents 66 at the time, my mother 65 at the time. Actually, he would have been 65 at the time, she would have been 64. But anyway, and so I decided that I would prove this by getting them a PC, loading up Linux on it, and basically setting it up for them and walking away. Because as far as I'm concerned, the big advantage of Windows is it comes pre-installed. That's it. That's where it ends. So I gave my parents a PC running Linux with, in fact, Red Hat Linux at the time, with KDE, an early version of, you know, the KDE 2 desktop. And I let them go with it. It's 3 years later. This is the only thing my parents have ever known. They play music. They write letters. They surf the web. They do email. They've got an instant messaging client. In fact, they've got GAIM running on the other side, or game, whatever you want to call it. I'm running Copete on this side, and we send little messages, you know, back and forth, or, you know, from time to time. So what I was trying to do was say, look, Linux is ready for the desktop, to use a phrase that's been overused. And it's ready for the average person, and it's ready for anyone to sit down and do whatever the heck it is they do with Windows, they can now do with Linux. And that's what I was trying to do, and that was my purpose.
Well, you start out by trying to get people, lead people through. It's kind of like a how-to in a way, that you're leading people through the installation, and, you know, you talk about dual booting and all sorts of stuff. But what's kind of nice about it is that that could be a book into itself. And what you do is you defer the gory details on some of the more esoteric parts of installing to websites, and you have lots of hyperlinks.
Well, as far as installation is concerned, any one of us out here knows that a modern Linux installation is actually as easy. In fact, it is easier than any Windows installation. You sit down with a Linux installation, a Mandrake 9.2, a Zuse 9.0, you know, a Red Hat 9.0, whatever. You sit down with that, you plunk that disk in, and you basically answer a couple of questions, next, next, next. And guess what? Not only is your system completely set up after the disks have finished spinning, but your internet connection is set up. Your drivers pretty much all work. I realize there are a few exceptions. In fact, I don't hide that in the book, the idea that things like WIN modems are a problem and so forth. In fact, since you've read the book, you know that I make a point of saying, yes, these things can be problems, but of course I tell you how to get around some of those problems as well.
Yeah.
But it is easier than Windows to install, so why spend a huge amount of time? Why spend a whole book on installation?
Yeah, and you even list the modems that the WIN modems, or as you call them, also LIN modems, that are these proprietary modems that do work with Linux.
That's correct, yes.
So people can go out and get that inexpensive WIN modem and use it.
Yeah, and, granted, you have to compile drivers for them. Although there's an alternative now that I won't get into right at this very moment. But, hey, it's doable. And, of course, if you happen to be lucky enough to have a DSL connection or a cable connection, you know, it'll just happen magically for you. It's great.
Yeah. Now, in the bulk of the book involves using Linux.
That's correct, yeah.
And you have a huge amount. I can't count the number of applications. This is a treasure trove, and let me tell you, I found it useful.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I've been using with Linux for years and years, and there were some things in here that I didn't know.
thank you.
And this is a really, really nice book on using applications. And it's quite that deep. There's games, there's video, there's even scanner software listed in here. And you go through with quite a lot of depth. I mean, this book would be a great comfort to somebody trying to use Linux for the first time.
And really, that was the idea. I mean, I wanted to give enough depth. I mean, it's nice to introduce someone to something. But of course, as soon as they get introduced and they start getting into it, I mean, you got to give them things that, you know, that are going to make the experience that much richer. And of course, that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to give them more, you know, this is how you start, these are the basics, now add this, and so forth. And at some point you go, wow, I'm doing real stuff with the system, you know, and I'm doing all the things I used to be able to do with Windows, and guess what, it's better.
Yeah, let's see, you have OpenOffice here?
Yes.
And you have And you go through each one of the main, three main apps, the spreadsheet, the word processor, and the presentation. You even have GIMP.
That's right.
Brave soul, you.
Hey, well, you want to touch up those family photos after you've downloaded them from your digital camera, no?
Yeah. Yeah, and at least you have sense enough to point them to the GIMP tutorial online, because you can get teach yourself GIMP in 24 hours.
But you know, I mean, the GIMP is not as complicated as, you know, as we might think. I mean, once you've loaded up an image and you right click on it, you just start playing. You know,
yeah.
It's like, well, what is this? You know, filter. What does that do? And you look at it and you go, ooh. It makes the picture look all, you know, all wobbly, like there are waves in front of it. Well, what does this next one do? Oh, it makes it look metallic. I mean, in some ways, that's really all it takes. And what I do with a lot of those things is I say, look, try this. In fact, I'm a big try this guy. You know, I like getting people to, you know, start something up, try these things, now try this thing and so forth. And then what I'm hoping is they walk away going, wow, that's pretty cool.
Have you seen the cover of my current book?
Yes, I have.
I did part of that art with the GIMP, and I'm not a trained artist.
the GIMP is great. I mean, it's a wonderful, powerful tool. Even something like Adobe Photoshop. I mean, let's just walk over to the other side, to the dark side, for a second. It's, you know, you say, well, geez, you know, it's a Windows application. It's really, really simple. It's really, really easy. You sit down and start working with that thing and come up with something that looks really good in a short period of time. You'll be going through the same learning process that you would with the GIMP.
Yeah, because it's not really the controls. It's the domain-specific knowledge about what to do with them.
Of course. I mean, every application has some things that you have to learn to get used to it.
Yep. One of the listeners in the show just asked a question, is the focus on the desktop, KDE or GNOME, and I already know that it's KDE. Was there a reason why you chose to focus it on one single GUI?
Yes, there was. Well, first of all, there are a heck of a lot of GUIs out there. And I have to admit, I'll express my personal bias right off the bat. My favorite GUI is KDE, followed by WindowMaker, followed by IceWM. You know, I mean, I love WindowMaker because I love doc apps. I just love doc apps. I think those are way cool. So I flip back and forth between all sorts of desktops. In fact, I run XNest, the Nested X server, on my desktop, so I can play with different desktops even while I'm running my current desktop. So that gives you an idea of just how, you know, strange I can be about some of these things.
That's bizarre.
What's that?
That's bizarre.
I'll send you a screenshot.
Can I tell you guys an interesting bit of news about upcoming desktops?
What's that?
I had an email conversation with Keith Packard and Jim Geddes earlier today, and I looked at some screenshots of stuff that's coming up on freedesktop.org. They have working alpha transparency in X window managers, and it looks so cool. I've been looking at screenshots where they have semi-transparent pop-up menus with drop shadows. It looks amazingly good. This is coming within months.
This is coming from a hyper geek. You know, the idea that, you know, I love window dressing. But no, I should probably go back and answer the question, though, why I chose KDE.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, I chose KDE quite frankly because it's a hugely popular desktop for one thing. I mean, it does come with Mandrake, it does come with Zuse, it does come with the Red Hat. The Nopic CD, I remastered the Nopic CD to include with the book so people didn't actually have to go out and get a copy of Linux. They could just pop in the CD, boot it up, and actually start trying things. But I honestly felt, and again, this is a personal thing, but I honestly felt that the KDE desktop was just that much smoother and that much slicker and that closer to being friendly enough to turn over to, if you'll pardon the expression, a Windows user. You know, if that was the audience that I was addressing, and really that's what I was trying to do, I was trying to make the experience as positive and as easy as possible for people who are coming from the Windows world. And I honestly believed, and I still do, that KDE does that better than just about anything else at the moment.
And you know what? You had to choose one.
I had to choose one.
You couldn't. You're right. You could not cover them all. And you do point out that there are others.
Mm-hmm.
In the book.
And in fact, I recommend in the book that in one of the things I recommend is I say, look, when you're busy installing your new distribution, because of course I do tell people, you know, go out and get yourself a Linux distribution once you've, you know, after you've played with the Nopix disk and so forth. I mean, yes, you could install from the Nopix disk. I tend to stay away from that somewhat because the installers in, you know, the modern Linux distributions that are out on the market are actually a lot friendlier than the one that comes with the Nopix disk. But that aside, I tell them go out, you know, when you go out and you get your actual Linux distribution and you're ready to install it on your PC, I make a point of saying install GNOME as well. Install IceWM if you have the option. In other words, get all the, I mean, you've got a huge disk out there. You've got lots of room and so forth. Install two or three or four different desktops. And you know what? Try them. Like, I'm going to show you how to work with this one in the book, but I'm encouraging you, you know, when you're feeling more comfortable to, you know, boot back up and try the other desktops and see whether or not it doesn't work better for you.
And they all have similar type tools.
Absolutely. You know, right-click, menu pops up, click that little, you know, that little button, the start button in the bottom left-hand corner, and, you know, you get a menu with applications and so forth, and you pick what you want from there. So, there are ideas that are consistent across a lot of these things that they can take with them.
Okay, now, I already told you before we actually came on for the segment that I've already gotten through about 3.5 chapters of the book, and I've been reading it side by side with an old copy, admittedly an old copy of Linux for Dummies, and comparing it topic by topic to see how it's organized and really focusing on the audience that you're addressing and how you're going through the process. And you really, during the break, I told you that I really am amazed at the fact that you are producing a book that is actually more readable than the For Dummies book, and yet you haven't gone through the same editing process that they have. And that's a remarkable thing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Now, having said that, now that I've built up your ego...
Go ahead.
I have one little suggestion for the book.
Talk to me.
Well, it's too late, I mean, to get it into the book, but you should seriously consider putting together some form of companion document that has actual tasks or exercises that could be defined in some scope as curricula. I was talking to Eric about this a few weeks ago. Eric just wrote a really marvelous book on excuse me, the art form of writing Unix. And he is right now going through the process of looking at his book, which is also a marvelous book, at developing curricula to go along with it, a teacher's guide.
I basically finished the teacher's guide, yeah.
So basically all you have to do now is write it, put together like a lab book, and that would be it. You should seriously consider doing that as well with this book. There is, if you look at the availability of text material within the world of Linux, there is none. We have a huge amount of very exceptional technical manuals.
This would be a very good introduction.
We have no text.
This would be a very good intro to Linux course.
If it had a lab book with it.
Well, for what it's worth, I am working on that.
Oh, good.
Good, because we need it. We need texts. We need Linux tests. People, we've got enough Linux books written. We now need texts written, and they're a different creature. They really are a different creature.
Well, if there's something that you'd desperately like to see in there, you know, I'm still open for ideas at this point. It's not set down in stone yet.
I'll be happy to give you some information on that, but we're not going to get into the college system until we have better teaching materials. I have been, for the better part of the last year and a half, trying to get an associate's degree program crafted on Unix. And there's no Unix test. Forget Linux. There's no Unix text out there. And
that's almost bizarre, actually.
Yeah, well,
hmm.
It's sad. I mean, you look through the plethora of Microsoft textbooks that are available, and you've got nine different choices to Sunday, and typically within a specific focus of Unix, you may have one text, and that's it.
Well, you know, I'm stating the obvious here, but I think we're there, and not in terms of, you know, the material is available, but what you just said there about, you know, in colleges and for training for the average person and so forth, I think we're at the point where the world is ready for us, so to speak. You know, as in is ready for Linux to make a big splash to, in fact, you know, it used to be at one time that people would ask me the question, so what's this Linux thing I keep hearing about? Okay, the most common question I get from people who aren't running Linux these days is, what do I have to do to run Linux on my system? That's a completely different question. And what it does is it shows that there's been a huge sea change in the way that people think about Linux. You know, and I'm talking about in the general, you know, Windows using world.
A lot of people think that Linux is just a program they runs under Windows.
Yeah, you know, I've run into that too.
Yeah, and this type of book, and it just the title begs for it. Moving to Linux, Kiss the Blue Screen of Death Goodbye. You know, it gets people thinking, you know, what, so this is Linux, and the idea, and this is the brainstorm of the whole thing, of including Canopix, a bootable Linux CD, as part of the book is really, I mean, people are going to buy this book, they're going to try it, and because it's Canopix, it's just going to work, and you're going to move some people to Linux with this.
That is entirely my intention, and the idea of using the Canopix or Nopix? I always call it Nopix.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know either.
The T is silent, like in farce.
But the idea behind using that disc, like I said, I remastered it and I did a few things to it before I actually, you know, had it ready to go in the back of the book. But the idea was, I was convinced that, you know, there were a lot of people that if they thought they could try this, you know, without blowing away their system, without erasing their Windows system and so forth, I'd have a much better chance to win them over.
Yeah.
And that was the idea behind that. I wanted to give them a what I call a no commitment.
Well, you know, there's some divergence between the book and the Nopix distribution.
Oh, absolutely, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said, it was I did remaster it. I did things that I thought were, there were applications that I removed from the actual Nopix distribution. There were things that I added. Basically, what I wanted to do was make it so that almost everything now, I mean, I couldn't put everything even, I mean, there's only so much room, even, you know, as magical as Klaus Knopper's disc is, there's only so much room on that thing. So I did try to get as many applications as possible on the disk that are covered in the book, so that they can basically walk from one end of the book to the other and try as many things as humanly possible, you know, before they walk away and go, yes, this is for me, because that's the end result that I'm looking for, them thinking, you know, this isn't so scary, this isn't so bad, and yes, I want to run Linux. Go ahead.
The main thing is the open office stuff will work, which is the three biggies.
Yes, absolutely. And you have no idea how many times I rewrote those three chapters. those were such a big deal for me, and I felt that they would be such a linchpin for people to move to Linux. You know, the idea that the Microsoft Office replacement, you know, was something that they had to be comfortable with, that they had to understand. And of course, you know, I can only do it in so many pages. I mean, there's I have a copy of the the Hoagland Jones Open Office Resource Kit book. You know, I mean, it's a monster of a book covering Open Office, but I had to cover it in a fairly small section. And like I said, I rewrote it several times before I was happy with it, before I had something that I thought would cover as much ground as possible and make people as comfortable as possible with Open Office in as short a time as possible.
Three short chapters.
Yes.
Well, the word processor one is the longest one, but with good reason. But
well, because a lot of the things that happen in the word processor are actually consistent when you get to the spreadsheet and even the presentation graphics package. So I don't recover the basics again. I say, look, you do this exactly the same way that you did it with the word processor.
Did you really cover the KDE presentation graphics thing?
No, I did not. Oh. I covered OpenOffice Impress.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, see, that's one thing. I mean, I chose the KDE desktop as the desktop that people would be working with.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's not specifically a KDE book. I thought KDE was the best environment to have them work in, you know, if I had to choose one. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, I mean, I use the GIMP for graphics. I use GRIP for, you know, for ripping your MP3s off of disks and so forth. I use GAME for the instant messaging application. I decided to pick and choose the applications that I thought made the best collection, you know, in terms of people starting out and playing with. And, of course, at the end of each chapter, I say, look, this is the one that I covered, but you may want to look at these others as well.
That's another thing, a feature I liked about the book. For instance, you cover KMail in Evolution.
Yes.
But you mention even Mutt in Pine.
That's right.
and actually, when you get to the back of the book.
I love Pine.
Appendix B of the book is another important chapter. Maybe you want to mention, tell us something about that and how what you were going for in the take command.
Yes. Throughout the book, I've got little sections, and not every single chapter, but in a lot of the chapters, I've got little sections I call take command. And again, this is something that goes. If we go back even to you know, the Windows world, people occasionally will open up a DOS prompt, and they'll be told to type copy A colon star dot star blah blah, right? So I wanted to introduce people to the Linux shell, to the Bash shell, without, you know, saying, hey, look, every once in a while you're going to be asked to go down and do something. You're going to be asked to do something down at the Linux shell. And this is how it works. So what I do is I tell them, okay, now open up a shell, try these commands, do this, now close the shell, and you're done. So I do this throughout the book, showing them how to do certain things. Like, for instance, under devices, I show them how to use the KDE device manager so they can find out, what PCI devices they've got connected. But then I say, I have a little take command section that says, by the way, if you open up a Linux shell and you type lspci, you'll get that information there as well. You know, obviously there are different ways to do things, or as we're fond of saying in the Linux community, there's more than one way to do it. Now, at the end of the book, as you say, Appendix B is what I call an extended take command section, and it's about 15, 20 pages where basically I say, okay, here are a whole bunch of other things that you can do with the Linux, you know, with the Linux shell, the born-again shell. And when it's all said and done, and of course I show them how to list processes and how to list their files and how to look at permissions and how to do a whole bunch of things down in the shell in that extended shell out section or take command section. Actually, I call them shell out.
Shell out. That's kind of fun.
Yeah, and at the end of it, I say, now that you've done all these things and you see that it's not all that complicated, here are a few other resources on the shell that you may want to look at so that you can become a Linux guru.
The Bash prompt how-to.
That's right, which is an excellent document.
There's a couple other questions that are popping up in the IRC. First of all, how well do you cover printing as a general thread in the book?
Okay, what I use in the book is... I do this through the KDE interface, specifically K Control, the KDE control panel. But I use cups. to answer the question. That's the printing system that I cover. And primarily because of, you know, the very friendly, and again, I hate to use that expression, Windows-y sort of because I felt the people who were coming from the Windows world would like the idea, you know, what do you want to call this printer? You know, click next, and then it says, here's the list of printers, you know, printer, model number, and so forth. Take that. What do you want to call it? And it's just, you know, click next, click next, click next. It's very friendly, very easy to use, and it's actually covered in substantial detail so that anybody can set up their printer.
Okay.
Yeah, I use cups, and it's pretty good, and actually it does a fairly good job with my two-sided HP printer, and it's nice. I'm glad you used cups. But you do mention the other ones, too.
I do, but cups is the one that I cover in detail.
Yeah.
Next question.
Well, that was the other one, is do you cover cups?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do.
That's excellent. Yeah, well, my kudos. It's a great book.
Thank you.
Even with the minor change I would make to it, I still it's a marvelous book. You should be very proud of it. I hope the sales go well, and I'm gonna.
Actually, it's already in its fourth printing.
Oh,
my
cool.
Goodness.
So it's actually doing quite well. So we stand a good chance of, you know, converting a lot of Windows users out there.
And how long has it been out?
I'm sorry?
How long has it been out?
August.
And you're in your fourth printing?
Fourth printing, and it came out in August?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been doing great. The response on it has been fantastic. I mean, you can even it's showing up. One of the things that I think is really cool is it's starting to show up in like not just the Borders and the Barnes and Nobles, but the Walden books in the stores as well. So, or in the malls as well. You know, the smaller bookstores.
When
so
I see
think
it,
that's really cool.
When I see it on the magazine rack at Albertson's grocery store. I'll know here in California. I'll know that you've made it, Marcel, and I'll send you a telegram.
Hey, don't just send me a telegram. Take a picture, for God's sakes, and send it to me. I'll print the silly thing up and put it up on my wall. I mean, man, that'll be just way cool. sorry, I may have digressed there.
That's okay. We are running out of time, and I do have a couple of announcements.
All right.
I'd like to make before we sign off for the evening. I put up on the website this evening that we were going to make an announcement about SCO during the show, some special news about SCO, as if we haven't had enough SCO news. But we do have something special that we do want to announce tonight, and that is that for those of you who are unaware, Don McBride has been asked to give a keynote speech at one of the events that is going on in Las Vegas next week. A lot of people have given criticism to the Enterprise Week management for even inviting him. After talking it over with the people at Enterprise Week, I really think that those people do have their heads together, and they are doing a great service to not only the Linux community, but the entire world for having Darryl deliver one of the keynotes to illustrate the point of why I think they have their heads together. Is they know, they have known that this is such a controversial thing for them to do, because not many people like Darryl right now, that they planned from the get-go, at least from the minute that they invited him, to have a town hall meeting immediately following the keynote address, and give not only the people in the audience, but to give some other pundits the opportunity to voice their opinions on the direction of enterprise IT, and in specific, the assertions that Darryl McBride is going to make in his keynote. I don't know how very many of you have been paying attention to the press releases that SCO has been issuing the last week about Darryl's keynote next week, but the level of silliness going on at SCO has reached unbelievable proportions in terms of the number of contributing factors that Darryl's now blaming on poor, poor, pitiful SCO, and why why people should pay them licensing fees and allow SCO to defend the American way of life. It's just downright goofy. But the special announcement that really I'm making tonight is I was asked to participate in the town hall meeting to represent the people within Linux Media to offer information to those who ask for it and evidence to contradict the assertions that SCO has been piling on the last several months. So for those of you who are regular listeners to the show and happen to work in the Vegas market, number one, I'm going to be looking for some help next week. I do need one or two people to volunteer to help us out getting things organized in Las Vegas when we are there. You can contact me directly here at The Linux Show. Just email me at jeff@thelinuxshow.com. And if somebody has enough time to really give me about 5 or 6 hours on Monday and Tuesday, I'll even pay to, or I should say I'll give you a ticket to get you into the conference. Those tickets to get into the conference are worth about $500 a day, so this is a pretty good deal, at least from my standpoint. Also, I am soliciting for people who have always wanted to ask Darryl McBride a question to please put a little thought in this and email me at, again, jeff@thelinuxshow.com with any suggestions or ideas you have on fun questions that I might be able to ask Darryl during our town home meeting. How this is going to actually impact the show next week, we are not sure yet. The town hall meeting is going to start about 15 minutes prior to our normal show startup. It is the hope right now that we're going to be kicking the show off about 15 minutes early and actually broadcast the town hall meeting live on the Internet. The people at Enterprise Week magazine are working on getting all those details worked out for me right now. We'll probably post something up at the Linux Show website over the weekend to let you know how the plans are shaping up. But next week looks like it's going to be an interesting week in the history of the SCO story. Finally, somebody is going to actually have the opportunity to corner Darryl McBride and either get him to answer questions or get him to run away, one of the two. The even money right now is on Darryl's going to run away. But we'll see next week how that all shapes up. In the meantime, though, Marcel, thanks for coming on the show tonight. And Eric, you too. Eric, don't go away. I'd like to talk to you offline if I could.
Okay.
But on behalf of the whole crew at the Linux Show, hey, we're really happy that you all listened to the show tonight. We're thankful to all you people out there in the RRC group. Please come back next week. Don't go away. Tell 10 of your friends to come by and check out the Linux Show. Our community grows bigger and bigger every single week. And
yes, tell everyone. I mean, it's as cheap as the price of an Internet connection.
Yeah, even less.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's been great fun.
No problem, Marcel. We're glad to have you, and we'll have you back anytime.
Hey, sounds like fun.
On behalf of the whole crew here at the Linux Show, that's it, everybody. We'll see you next week. We are out of here.
If he is the sun and she is the sea and she bleeds, from every dawn to every dusk of every day. If she is the boat and he is the breath that stirs the gale, the crest and fall and thrust and throw the bill on the sail. If he is the sextant, she is the stars by which he guides, from sombering sea to port at every